Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and this is the Commonwealth Writers Podcast, celebrating 10 short story writers from 5 regions of the Commonwealth. We're calling it 10 by 10, which means I've got only 10 minutes to talk to each author. Today, we're hearing from the Australian writer Janine Leanne. Hello there, Janine. I wish I were with you. It's a long way to come to interview you, though, so we can try to imagine that we are sitting face to face and talking to each other one-on-one, which would be lovely. Now, I'm going to ask you, Janine, to describe yourself as a writer, as a person.
Oh, okay. As a writer and as a person, I mean, it's really hard to make a distinction between the two because as a child, I was always wanted to be a writer. We grew up in a house with lots of aunties and not a lot of money. And so I used to write little stories on old-fashioned bread paper and butcher's paper and draw pictures to go with them. And I grew up listening to a lot of stories because Aboriginal people are an oral culture. And it's also that sense of history, that sense of story was what really inspired me to write Purple Threads as a collective memoir of short stories that really were formative for me growing up and that has made my life what it is now.
As you say, Aboriginal peoples have always told stories, and you've always told stories, and you heard them from these amazing, resilient women you grew up with. But you also are part of this group of Aboriginal writers who've been able to print and distribute your stories much more widely.
Yes. After the settler bicentenary of 1988, there was a real change, I think, in the Australian consciousness, or it was the beginning of a big change in terms of settler attitudes towards Aboriginal people and our cultural expression. And there were a number of initiatives. In particular, there was the Queensland University Press that sought funding to have the David Unaipon Award, which was named after a man, a Nurringeri man, which is South Australia here, who was the first person to actually get some things in print, and that was very early in the 1920s. The University of Queensland Press named an award in his honour and called for unpublished writing by Indigenous writers in any genre, which is also a very big deal, really, because, you know, a lot of our stories span different genres, and then we have song poetry and things like that. So that was a very important thing. And then as a result of that too, a number of our Indigenous people started writing together. So there was a whole sort of blossoming of writers' groups, which we all sort of gained strength from each other's strengths with our writing as well.
Do you think that Aboriginal writing today is equal to white Australian writing?
I think probably not quite yet, but certainly over the last 25 years, and this is one of my research projects because the Unaipon Award is coming up for 25 years old this year, there is still some way to go, but certainly up until 1988, the lack of representation of Aboriginal writing in print literature was striking, actually. And I think that now in Australia, with Aboriginal writing, not just because of the Unaipon Award, but the Unaipon Award's been a very significant intervention in Australian literary culture.
And we mustn't forget the Commonwealth Writers Book Prize as well.
And also there's been other people like Larissa Berendt and Alexis Wright all did very well with the Commonwealth Writers Prize, as well as myself too.
And what are you writing about, Janine? You're writing about women. I know you're writing about family and to a certain degree injustice and so on. I mean, do you call yourself an activist writer?
I think I am an activist writer, but activism really needs a face, and I think that the best way to be an activist is through people's real stories, because the stories are there. It's just a question of bringing them out to people and in a way that people can relate to, you know. I mean, I think many people would be sympathetic, concerned, disturbed to hear about the Stolen Generations, for example, in Australia. But when you actually read how it affected a particular family or a particular person or a particular group that you've already built some empathy and rapport with through a collection of stories or through an unfolding story, then I think it just makes the impact of that so much more real to people. So, you know, just to be still here and to be so proud of it and to, you know, to identify ourselves as Australia's first people, just even being alive, I say this to my students, is for Aboriginal people is political.
Janine, there's one thing that I want you to briefly talk about, which I think is incredibly important to what you do and what you write about, is this idea of nation writing. Can you explain why this is so significant?
Yes, nation writing. I mean, there are a lot of settler writers. I did my PhD about how settlers represented Aboriginal people, you know, in exile, because of the earliest settlers were all British settlers, white settlers. I mean, that's not the case now, but that was the case before. And there was a real, particularly the 20th century, saw a real urgency on the part of settlers to write their own identity into this nation, which was quite foreign to their ancestors and still to them in a way. So their writing of Australia as a nation and their national sense was important to them. But a lot of that actually either ignored or misrepresented Aboriginal people. And so I think since the late 80s, beginning more nascently in the 60s with some very important activist writers like Ujiru Noonacal, who was also known as Kath Walker, and Kevin Gilbert, Jack Davis, and Sally Morgan, as a sense of urgency for us to write ourselves back into our country, because we were always here but not always heard. And it is very important now that we write our sense of place and our sense of belonging back into this settler canon that already exists.
That's very exciting to hear, I must say. And one of the things that strikes me about your writing is that you never wag fingers. You're not accusatory, and you don't thrust the morality down people's throats with your writing. You were a finalist in the Commonwealth Book Prize 2012 with your linked short stories, Purple Threads. And I can immediately recall the wonderful character, Auntie Boo. Is she appearing in this particular extract you've chosen?
She will, yes, yes.
Good. I look forward to hearing your reading from Purple Threads and a little bit about Auntie Boo.
Country baked hard in January. Sweat dripped like much-needed rain from the red necks and burnt noses of pig farmers as they slaved in the hot sun to dig wallows for their suffering sows. And giant white sows, heavily pregnant, sweltered the long days away in thick grey mud. The women in town sat in their cotton print dresses on the cool verandas of the grey-blue river stone and fanned themselves with imitation oriental fans as they drank weak black tea from fine china cups. From time to time they pulled crisp, white, embroidered handkerchiefs from their handbags and wiped away the sweat that fell in big greasy sheets of foundation and scented powder from their faded faces. Their mascara ran like black tears. Auntie Boo said they looked like sad dolls, and the sun glinted a spectrum of coloured rays from their tinted hair. In the August rains, the Murrumbidgee would swell. Sometimes it would devour the trees on the floodplain as the waters shrank and the river gums were adorned for months afterwards with the slender skeletons of cattle and sheep swept away in flash floods. And as the big brown waters receded further through September, the land was bountiful with ducks, fish, goanna, kookaburra, platypus, frogs, snakes, grass and flowers. Through October, the green faded from the tall grass and the river swell subsided to a flow. Grass lilies of flame, red, umber, yellow, blue, pink, purple, mauve, cream and white carpeted the hills. November saw the river flow slow and ebb, and as the grasses turned from olive to russet, the lilies wilted as the sun burned, drawing the last reserves of water from the earth. The musky, stagnant smell of drying water was pungent. In December, the grasses were bone and the lilies became brown bowls that shook in the hot wind. Moths and butterflies and beetles made their way to the hills for some reprieve from the swelter to come. The January dryness snapped the life and moisture from the